accession number 10170, reel number 6.
Mr. Walter Spencer, reel 6. Did you have any attitude to shell shock, or did you see any examples of shell shock?
There were a very few of my battalion who did suffer from shell shock and had to be returned to England, I think, in consequence, but I didn't see many.
Did you believe in it yourself? What did you think shell shock was?
Well, it's just a matter of nerves, shell shock. It's, of course, as one person is differently, we'll say, created to another, and some are stronger nerved than others, but it was usually the weak ones who couldn't stand it.
So you didn't have a lot of sympathy for it?
Well, no, but it was a thing which I believe was genuine, because the chap couldn't put it on and kind of get out of the army by feigning it, we'll say. He couldn't beat the doctors with it.
What sort of symptoms would it show?
Mostly a shell-shock person was trembling, you see, all over. And you could tell by his general demeanour and his speech if he generally got it or was putting it on.
What about self-inflicted wounds in the battalion or desertion? Were there any cases of that?
Very few. I couldn't mention... I don't think I can mention instances of any self-inflicted... And there used to be a lot of tales about self-inflicted wounds, but I don't think they did take place much. One chap I know who got wounded, this is true, was when we were just as we were going up the line, he went to the incinerator where they destroyed things in the camp where you were, and there was a full tin of jam had been put in, and it exploded, and it went all over his face, and it burnt all his face, and he was going up the line. He got his ticket through it. That was the easiest way out, wasn't it?
So was there much need for military discipline to be enforced?
Much.
Any military punishments, field punishment number one or that, within the battalion?
There was a bit of it all the time, because some fellows didn't quite do what they were told. Like, if a chap didn't obey a command, you see, he could be what they call put in the book, and he'd usually, when he was back, receive so many extra drills or fatigues or something like that. I only saw one chap doing number one field punishment, and he was strapped to a wheel of a limber, and like a cross, his arms are like this, his legs strapped in his arms, and he had to stand there for an hour every day, and it was hot summer's day when I saw him, and I think he had actually he'd tried to escape, you know, get out of the army. He was brought back from some French place where he'd stayed, and he was charged with desertion. And he got, I don't know how long he got, but I did see him myself.
So there were no executions while you were there?
Oh, no.
How did you get on with your fellow soldiers? Did you make any special friends in the front line? I know you said that the difficulty in the army was they kept leaving, but did you have any special friends or characters of note that you can recall?
Yes, but you see, it again was trouble, because your friends weren't there long, or you weren't there, or you weren't there yourself. The rate of casualties was keeping you from having a permanent friend, and you were constantly having to make friends with somebody who came up in the next draft, you see.
Did you find it easy to make friends?
Well, generally speaking, yes, because we were all more or less in the same boat. Everybody was out there to do the best for the king and country and to try and get back to England if they possibly could.
What about the NCOs? How were they more friendly in the line?
Well, some are not. No, in our regiment, an NCO was not really allowed to associate with private soldiers, you see. Not in entertainment world.
What about in the front line, though? Would you be on first?
Well, in the front line, they used to climb down a bit, of course. And you did used to hear tales from other regiments where they'd shot the sergeant major or something like that when they got to the front line. But we had nothing like that occurred.
Would you call them by the first name in the front line, or would they live amongst you, or were they still very separate, really?
No, you'd call them sergeant or corporal. You'd never call them by the first names, and you'd call them by the... If you knew Sergeant Smith, you wouldn't say Sergeant Smith, you'd say Sergeant, you see.
Did the NCOs live amongst you?
Yes, yes, more or less. The corporals and sergeants lived with the privates, but they gave the orders. I mean, you still had to kind of look up to them.
Where were the officers' billets?
Well, the officers...
Not billets, dugouts. Were they in this front line or were they behind?
Well, they always had a place in the front line where the officer on duty was. By the way, there was always what they call a picket officer on duty in the front line, and they would relieve one another at that, you see, but they always had to come along to give the orders and that kind of thing. But we never associate with the officers in any shape or form.
Where were the officers back then? Where were the rest of them other than the picket office? Were they... How far back were they?
Well, there was a company headquarters in the rear of the front line, and that's where the commanding officer and second-in-command and the adjutant were, and that was... like the orderly room would be back behind the line. That was the orderly room which gave orders out to the whole of the battalion, you see.
Do you think the officers had superior living conditions to the privates or the other ranks?
They might have had a little superior one, but they definitely had better rations. They had their own rations, of course. They didn't eat bully beef and that kind of thing.
Was there any envy of them amongst the troops? Were the troops envious of the officers, or did they accept it?
Well, they just accepted it. We knew we had to have officer, we had to have somebody in command, and in time you got used to it. And the officers wouldn't know you personally. They wouldn't be stoop to that.
What about other types of troops? I mean, you were frontline troops often. What did you think of things like the Royal Army Medical Corps?
They were very good, the RAMC were. Of course, they helped to dispose of bodies and to take the wounded and all that kind of thing. They did a lot of good.
They had a good reputation, then?
Oh, yes, good reputation. They were considered to be very essential and very useful men, because half of them had a good medical experience, you see, and they could help treat a few wounded.
What about the Army Service Corps, things like that? The people who never came forward, the Army Service Corps, the military police, what did people think of them?
Well, the Army Service Corps were very popular because they used to handle their rations, you see. And another thing about the Army Service Corps, if you knew a chap in the Army Service Corps and you were going on leave, he'd invariably be going down to one of the channel ports, perhaps with his vehicle for supplies that were coming up to the line, and he'd ride you down, you see, instead of you going on an old French train.
Was there any envy of their relatively safe existence?
Was there
any envy of their relatively safe existence? I mean, you were frontline troops. Was there a sort of difference?
Well, they were, but you see, again, they had to expose themselves to danger every time they brought rations up to the front line. So, I mean, everybody had a certain amount of danger to contend with. Even the men right behind the line, they were getting these big guns firing at them, shrapnel and that kind of thing. And you weren't safe within, we'll say, generally about 5 miles behind the front line. You weren't safe.
So you saw that everybody had a role and that they were all exposed to danger in some form or other. That's how you saw it when you were in the front line.
Oh, yes, yes.
What about the generals and the sort of strategy of the war?
Well, you very seldom saw them. The only time you saw them were in the air to the line, and they had these what they call divisional parades, when the whole division went on parade and he addressed the troops, and that would only occur perhaps once a year or something like that, when there was a necessity, you see. If he had to proclaim that there was an armistice, he'd declare it, you see, with a loudspeaker to the whole division.
And what did you think of these speeches by the general, the divisional general? What sort of things were they saying? How relevant was it to you?
Well, they wouldn't divulge any secrets, you might say. Even if we were making an attack, they wouldn't tell you much about it. All you'd know before you went to attack was what you're attacking, what where to make for. You always had to select the places you could see so that they can make for it.
Did you have confidence in the generals and their staff?
Oh yes, we had great confidence in them. Of course, there were some of them who would throw men's lives away unnecessarily. They always used to say that Haig was a man who didn't care how many soldiers died, you see, how many were killed.
But did you say that at the time, or is that post-war?
No, we said at the time.
So Haig himself wasn't popular?
Well, he wasn't popular, no. The most popular man I knew of in the army was Lord Gort. Lord Gort used to be our commanding officer, by the way, and he feared nothing and nobody. And wherever he sent a man, he would go with him. He would be a man to, you know, he'd go over the top and go with the patrol, even.
He commanded the battalion,
He'd come out, yes, he was the head of the battalion. And, of course, he got to be field marshal, as you know, Lord
Gort. Do you remember anything else about Gort? Any stories that would illustrate his character?
Yes, I know. Several episodes. When he was with our battalion, we were on the march one day. I was thinking it would be a route march. We were behind the line anyhow. And there was a crowd of French lorries came along. And they were kicking up a hell of a dust, you see. And, of course, they were smothering all over the road, you see. And he stopped them. He drew his revolver and he said if he didn't stop there until his battalion had gone out the way, he'd shoot them. And he would have done, I believe. He was a good learner, was Gort.
Any other stories?
He stuck up for the PC, you know, for the bottom man. He'd go around your camp and see if you were comfortable when it were in your billets and all that kind of thing. He'd come into the line and see if you had any complaints. But, of course, a lot of officers wouldn't. He was always a very good chap to the troops. We were very sorry to lose him. Well, he went from us to the 1st Battalion, unfortunately, and he got the VC, you know, Gort did. But he's the bravest man I ever knew, was Gort. He feared nothing or nobody.
Did you ever see him in action? Did you ever actually see him in action, or was it his reputation?
Oh, no, I saw him. Saw him heaps of times. Now he'd be there. He'd make himself known. When the director of the battalion went into the trenches, he'd walk right along the firing line, the front trenches. Everything was all comfortable. Of course, if anything wanted doing, he'd tell him to do this and do that and give the orders what had to be done to get things proper. But he was amiable. He wasn't what I'd call a snob.
Was while you were in the trenches, was religion of any help to you at all? Were you religious-minded? Did that help you get through it all?
No, I don't think... they used to discuss religion, but I don't think it played any great part with anybody. They had their own beliefs, and most of them were turned to be fatalists, although they're wrong. They didn't bother about religion and whether they're going to be wounded or killed or what. They just said, well, what's coming to me will come, and that's it.
Did you ever see any of the religious personnel, the chaplain or the padres in the front line? Did they ever come around?
The padre used to come back up into the line. You'd usually see him once at any position where he'd walk through. And, of course, when you were back behind the line, he was quite a big feature because he used to get up concerts and all that kind of thing.
I'll come to that because I'm coming on to that, yeah. How did the front line differ from when you were in reserve lines? Actually in the line still, but in the reserve line in the Ypres area. What were the differences?
Well, in the reserve line, of course, you could stand upright and walk about and converse. You were freer altogether, you see. It was a place where you could rest, do a lot better. You see, you didn't get a lot of sleep, really, in the front line. You're interrupted by having to go on sentry duty, of course, every... so often, and other things of general turmoil, and back in the reserve trenches, you lost a lot of that, and you were more together as a groups.
Was there more fear of heavy artillery? You said that most of the heavy artillery was directed.
Yes, that was the biggest danger in the reserve trenches and communication trenches. You always had mostly shrapnel shells to contend with, because he'd send one over now and again, you see, and change in positions and all that kind of thing.
While you were at Ypres, I think when you were actually right back, you were at Poppering most of the time.
That's right.
That was where your billets were.
Poppering, yes.
What were your billets like? What sort of billets did you have there?
Mostly schools, and just outside Poppering, there were quite a lot of farms. You had barns, you see. You'd have a barn in a farm and probably hold 200 men, these very French barns. And they used to clear them out because they got a penny a night for every soldier who was sleeping there.
Was there much artillery fire around Poppering?
Yes, but we used to be bothered more there with German planes. They used to come over and bomb. They used to come over early morning, perhaps 4 o'clock in the morning.
Even in 1916 you'd get
that? Yeah, you'd be woke up with a tremendous crash, you know, and a bomb. And we got quite a lot of casualties from Pop through... aeroplane bombing.
Was there, you were in these billets. What was the food like when you were at Poppering?
Oh, quite good. Yes, of course, we got the advantage when you're out of the line, you got more bread. The bread was the thing which we were very short of when you're in the front line. It was mostly these very hard biscuits. They used to make what they call sandbag duff of these hard biscuits, you know. They used to get some currants and... moisten the biscuit down soft and mix with that and roll it out and then put it in a sandbag, and that was what was called sandbag duff.
That would be made when you were in rest, or was that made in the front line as well?
No, that was usually when we were out in either in the communication or back behind the line.
When you were out of the line, did you get back to kit inspections and generally spit and polish or bull as it's
called? Yeah, we always had a kit inspection when we returned from the front line. And if a man, for instance, that haversack of mine that was burnt through, I got a new haversack, you see. Everything was replaced that had been damaged or was not fit for service.
But you weren't charged for such things. You wouldn't be charged, of course.
Oh, no charge. No.
But how tidy, how smart were you expected to get your uniform and kit during the periods at Poppering? How smart, how tidy were you meant to be?
Oh, I see. Well, we had to shave every morning. We went on what they call breakfast parade. That's when you had to have your shoes cleaned and your buttons clean and be shaved.
So you went back to polishing your buttons when you were out of the line?
That's right. Yes, we did. And we all thought that was wrong.
Did you have to dull them when you went back in the line?
Well, you see, no. they did get dull, but Jerry, you see, had got a button that didn't polish. It was a black button. That all that shining was very unnecessary, we thought.
Was there any other spit and polish you had to do? You had to do your buttons?
Well, your rifle, of course. That always had to be up to now. Now, all your kit had to be clean, you see. You had to show a clean towel, and that was always a bit of a job, because you hadn't got much facilities for washing towels or anything like that, but you had to have a clean one. We usually tried to acquire an extra towel and save it for kit inspection only, you see.
What about what you call shining parades on your list? What were they?
Well, that was mostly buttons, and of course you got your haversack and... a water bottle, all those kind of things, they all had to be clean, and your entrenching tool had to be clean. If you used up the line, you had to get that up to strength again. There were quite a lot of cleaning to be done when you were back behind the line.
Did you resent it much? How much did you resent that?
Well, we all resented it, because although we believed in cleanliness, we didn't believe in the polishing kind of business. You could be clean without that. For instance, your boots, your ammunition boots, would be all clayed up, and you'd be expected to wash all the dirt off those and to get black them and shine them up.
Would you do many parades? Did you have many parades?
No, no. You'd have one main parade a day.
Was that a company or battalion parade?
That would sometimes be a battalion. Perhaps if you were there a long time, you'd have two battalion parades. And we'll say if you were out of the line a fortnight, you'd perhaps have a weekly battalion parade. But the other would be company parade. And you do route marches when you're back behind the line.
What were the route marches like in France?
Route marches were just a march around the countryside. It usually take about a couple of hours, and it usually occurred after the battalion parade at 9 o'clock in the morning. We should get on the march then till about 11, perhaps, and then dismiss for a midday meal.
Would you get rest periods during the march? Did you get rest periods?
Yes. You march for 20 minutes, and then you got a 5 minutes rest. You used to average 3 miles an hour, actually walking.
Were you allowed to sing on the march?
Yes, we were allowed to sing, whistle or shout. And you could talk, of course. Except when you were marching what they call march to attention, then everybody had to slope their rifle and not talk.
What sort of songs would you sing?
Well, all the popular music hall songs of the day. There's a long, long trail and back up your troubles and two or three. The current songs which have been sung in London, really, of the show.
Did you sing any of the more cynical or war-weary songs at this time that were going around, or were most of the songs fairly bright and optimistic?
They'd usually been manufactured by the chap who was singing, you know. We had battalion concerts, by the way, and anybody who could sing, they used to come and give us a song or anybody play the piano and that kind of thing.
I'll come back to that, actually, because that's interesting. But on the route marches, you mainly sing set songs. You wouldn't be allowed to make up songs that
about
the Sergeant Major or something like that.
Didn't have what we call smutty songs. We weren't allowed those.
What about rifle drill and general training? Did you do much of that while you were out of the line?
No, very little. Very little.
Did you write letters to home much?
Yes, you wrote letters to home and you read. If there are any shops in the vicinity, you try and get some cigarettes or whatever they got to sell. But
what sort of things would you write home? Did you tell your family what was happening to you, or did you just say you were well? What exactly would you say?
You wouldn't tell them anything about your location, where you were in the line, or when you've been in, whether you're out or anything like that, because that would be, of course, advantage to the enemy if he got all of the mail. But you'd talk about your relations, relatives, hope so-and-so as well. And, well, when you got a letter from them, you could answer it. You see, you got something to talk about.
So you wouldn't talk about the fighting much?
Oh, no, we kept off fighting altogether, yeah.
Did you have the field postcards and the green envelopes?
Yes, we had the green envelopes and the field postcards. We used to get an issue of a green envelope once a fortnight. That is if you behave yourself. If for any reason you're on punishment parade or anything like that, they'd stop your issue a green envelope. That would be part of your punishment.
And the green envelope was the one that wasn't censored?
The one that was uncensored, that's right. But you see, you never put anything in there which would be advantage to the enemy.
So it didn't make much difference to you?
No, but you see, if they trapped one, they occasionally used to open one, but they did open one, it gotten any military knowledge, and it will say that man would be punished.
Now, if we look at the recreations you're allowed, you said you used to read. What sort of reading? Where did you get your books and such?
Well, chiefly sent out from England. I had a periodical called Titbits sent out for me once a week. My sister used to send it. Titbits, that was an English paper, wasn't it? And they had short stories and puzzles and that kind of thing. I got that every week, provided the Jerry would allow the transport to come through with it.
Would you get parcels with our
Oh, yes, we got parcels,
got
parcels and foodstuff, chocolate, cigarettes, tobacco, and all kinds of sweetmeats, that kind of thing. You get them from Mum. Mother used to make a cake and send the cake out, it'd be all right. Because you'd get there about 2 days from the time she made it.
How often would you get those? Weekly or what?
Well, you see, different people go at different times, and you constantly, in your crowd, you'd you perhaps average one about every 2 days, and you'd share it among them, you see.
You say you used to read, you got tidbits, the tidbits newspaper from home. What else would you read? Was there any sort of battalion library of books?
No, not as a library. Sometimes you'd get a paperback book sent out to you, see a tale. Well, when you'd read it, you'd hand it to your mate, you see, and he'd hand it to his mate, and you'd get one from him, you see. We always had plenty of reading material, but none of us read French papers because we couldn't read the paper, couldn't read the French.
Did the battalion produce, or did you, any sort of news sheet, or did you get any of the other army-produced
No,
material?
Apart from what they call battalion orders, which used to be pinned up on a board or some conspicuous place, we didn't get anything supplied, not from the army side, not for reading.
Now, I noticed you say you played, they had a league for football. Did you play football yourself?
Yes, I played football.
How was it organised?
Well,
it
was organised. The officers used to usually do that kind of thing, and it was organised in divisions. Different divisions, you see, would every battalion would have a team. Well, there's 12 battalions, as you know, in a division. There's four battalions to a brigade and 3 brigades to a division. There's 12 battalions. Each had a football team. Well, they'd draw for who played who, you see. 2nd Grenadiers would play the 1st Scots, and the 1st Irish would play the 2nd Welsh. And then they'd find a convenient field, if possible, around where they were billeted, and they'd play a football match. And then there was an award at the end of the, the winter term, for there was a cup presented by one of the officers, and that was awarded to the winning team.
Was it a league system or a cup system?
Yes, it
overall?
Was more a cup system. You couldn't really have a league because it wasn't quite regular enough for that. You couldn't.
Did you get into the battalion team, or would you have to be very good to get into that?
I was in the battalion team. I was outside right for the 4th Battalion. But you see, there again was your trouble because probably your goalkeeper got wounded or killed last time up the line. You had to constantly be replacing men.
What standard of football? You'd played football before the war then?
Oh, yes, I'd played football before the war, yes. Yes.
So what standard would you say battalion football was?
Well, it was fairly good. I would say that they wouldn't be as good as our league football, we'll say, but for local teams like, we'll say, Carlton or even Notts Forest, well, they'd be as good as that. And the Royal Engineers always had a very good football team because, of course, they were mostly behind the line and they got plenty of practice.
were the games played very hard? Or was there a great rivalry between the Guards battalions?
There was quite rivalry, especially between the Grenadiers and the Coldstreams, because they both had good teams and played one another, you see, and we were out for winning the cup if we could.
Who won in the end, do you remember?
Well, yes, the Coldstreams beat us 1-0 in the final. 1 year, I remember. We played that at Poppering, the final.
Which year would that be, 16 or
17? 17, yeah.
Did you play at any higher level than battalion? Did you ever play for the division or...?
No, I never played for the division. I never got higher than the battalion.
What about at a lower level? There was a company games, inter-company matches.
Yes, the do you mean the company?
Within the battalion, you know, A company versus B company, that sort of
Oh,
thing.
yes. We also had a battalion competition, but the other was divisional, you see. Yeah. Yes, well, you'd try all your reserves, all you think were capable of playing in the battalion team, you'd try them out in the company match, you see, and if they were good enough, you'd promote them. Put someone else out.
Would officers? Do you say the officers organise it? Would the officers play?
Yeah, the officers invariably you'd have one officer would referee, and perhaps the other two more would run the line. You know, they would be the officials in charge of the match.
But would they actually play in the team?
No, they didn't play in the team. No, they wouldn't associate as strong as that. You see.
What other sports? Did you box at all? Was there any?
Oh,
boxing?
There was boxing. Yes, there was boxing and. Boxing and wrestling.
Did you box?
No, I didn't box myself, no. some fairly good boxers in there.
Would they get a crowd? Was it a populace?
You'd occasionally get a professional boxer. Iron Haig was a professional, and he was in our battalion at the time. Iron Haig. I always remember him, because he carried off the battalion cup for boxing.
What about wrestling? You mentioned that.
Wrestling, yes. Some quite good wrestlers, too. But we get... You see, provided we get the hall, we could put on plenty of talent. Out of 1,000 men, you'd invariably get one or two men who were very good at whatever it was, you see. And regarding the concerts, the padre used to exercise his skill in getting the concerts up, and a chap who I knew very well, named Best, B-E-S-T, he was a padre in London at... There was a